supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
We got her daddy's car and she cruised through the hamburger stand now. Seems she forgot all about the library like she told her old.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Yes, cars. We do love our cars, and our cars do something interesting to the human mind. To wit, I have a story to tell you. A couple of weeks ago, I left my home on a Monday morning to travel to this very radio station, and I was behind a car at a red light and noticed that the driver in front, his head was down, obviously texting someone or doing something, and the light turned green, and he didn't do anything, so I blew the horn. He was driving after that about 10 miles below the speed limit on a two-lane highway, still looking down, clearly texting somebody, and I'm getting frustrated because I've got to get to work on time. They are pretty finicky at radio stations about starting shows on time. But he's not moving, so I blow the horn again, and I turn on my lights, and now I'm driving pretty close to him. Yes, I'm tailgating, and I'm so frustrated that I dialed somebody on the cell phone to tell them what an idiot this guy was. And then I realized that I'm doing the same thing this guy was. So the question is, what's up with that? What's up with that guy, and what's up with this guy? To answer those questions and so many more about traffic, about the interaction between traffic, cars, and the human psyche, are two guests, Tom Vanderbilt, who's written the book Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do, and What It Says About Us. His blog is How We Drive. Tom, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Dan.
And Leon James is a psychologist, author of Road Rage and Aggressive Driving. He's taught traffic psychology at the University of Hawaii for 20 years. His website is drdriving.org. And Leon, welcome to the show.
Nice to be on your show.
Our phone number is 888-477-9499. That's 888-477-9499, although I doubt anybody has anything to say about driving and how they drive or how other people drive. But if you do, give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. So, Leon, let's start with you. So, my question about my driving and his driving, what's up with that guy and what's up with this guy?
Past training and habit. In other words, people don't realize that driver education starts when we are children, riding the back seat of the car, which we can call road rage nursery. And so we are trained by our parents and other adults to drive the way we do, and every generation does it a little bit worse. So I think that's what's going on. Without us realizing it, when we drive, we kind of fall back on the original training we've had as children.
Huh. Any other venues that inspire road rage besides our childhood?
Well, what's currently going on is that when we are driving, all these events occur that, for example, the one you described, and we are not trained to handle these traffic emotions, just like you realized that you're doing the same thing as this other driver you were reacting to. You were reacting to your traffic emotions that are not trained, and you didn't know what to do. So I think as long as our society doesn't face this issue of how do we properly train drivers throughout their career as drivers, not just for a year when they are teenagers, but throughout their lifelong driver education, then this kind of attitude and philosophy about driving and habit will continue.
Tom, why don't we obey speed limits? I mean, I think that's a safe generalization. We don't.
Well, it's a very good question. And, in many cases, speed limits are improperly set. You know, these sort of are done according to engineering precepts, which are often you know, out of date, or cars keep changing, drivers keep changing. You know, it is a funny question as to why we tend to obey some norms in traffic and tend not, or laws, and tend to sort of not obey others. An example was given to me of thinking of someone going about 10 miles over the speed limit, or maybe even faster on a highway, and they think that's just fine, and then coming to a sort of red light in the middle of nowhere in the middle of the night, and that person will sort of stop and sit at that traffic light very rigorously, even though they could sort of go through it with potentially no harm to themselves or anyone else, and probably not even getting a ticket, but we seem to follow laws like that a little bit more stringently, and it's an open question as to why. I think with speeding, we often don't respect the speeding limits. We think we're over-optimistic as to our own ability to, you know, we like to think we can drive better than everyone else. We can drive, you know, just fine. So perhaps our overconfidence plays more of a role in the speeding issue.
Is there any research that you're aware of, and I'll stick with you, Tom, about average number of miles over the speeding limit? You use that 10-mile-an-hour number. I know that's the case with me. I mean, I'm certainly not one of the faster drivers on the road. I'm one of the slower ones. But on an open highway with 55, I'll tend to drive 10 miles an hour over, certainly not more.
Yeah, I think that's become pretty much the accepted grace number, if you will, and various studies show different numbers on that, but at least for highway speeds. I mean, I live in New York City, and the thing to remember here, though, is about speed limits, which I always have to remind people about, is that what looks like a relatively minor difference in speed to the driver of a car in a place with a lot of pedestrians like New York City, I mean, if you look at the statistics for a pedestrian dying being struck by a car, they begin to really accelerate at 20 miles an hour, and from 20 to 30, it's something like a fourfold increase in the chance that pedestrian will die. So just to sort of keep in mind that seemingly minor increases in speed in some environments can be quite deadly.
Leon, we know that cell phone is a problem on the road, and we also know that using a cell phone hands-free is just as distracting. Why don't we know that our driving is impaired?
Because it's an emotional impairment, and normally people are not aware when they are emotionally impaired. That's part of the characteristic of being emotionally impaired, is that you're not fully aware of your mental state. As far as using the cell phone, it's true, that's what research shows, that it's dangerous because of distraction. So I think the solution would be, rather than to try to ban cell phones, which I think it's too late now,
right,
many people are using it, what we need to do is to take more seriously the idea that we need to train people how to use cell phones, and that's one area that's still left open to us. We need to train ourselves how to properly use cell phones so we don't get distracted. It is possible to do it. You see professional drivers, police, they use several multitasking facilities at the same time while they're pursuing somebody else, and they're able to do it. How come? That's because they've trained themselves. They've had the proper training and experience to develop the right habits. So people need to pay more attention to the idea that we need lifelong driver education. We need to continue training ourselves as we continue becoming more experienced.
I'm curious about that. How can we be trained to attend to two or more things at the same time with equal dexterity? I mean, I've read some neurological research that shows it can't be done. Whenever we multitask, something loses.
I think that's where training comes in. Every semester I ask my students about this, and some of them admit that, yes, they've trained themselves to do message texting while they're driving. And, you know, I was kind of horrified at first, but I realize now that, yes, you can do that. In other words, there are certain ways that you have to train yourself when you're not driving about how to manipulate the phone and how to do text messaging while you're not looking at your hand. People have not done that. It's amazing how much you can do when you actually train yourself.
Tom, on your blog recently, you said that there's a device that can be in car keys that both blocks calls and texting while in a driving mode. You support this?
Sure, and Ford is looking at something called, I think it's called My Key, which these are all oriented at teen drivers who are definitely, you know, among the in the highest risk pool and sort of have the most to learn from this. Although, as Dr. James suggests, you know, driver training is and should really be a lifelong process. I recently took a driving test in England, for example, and failed. So, and I've been driving for over 20 years. So there's clearly a lot for us to learn, but. Yeah, so I would support this and think it would be a good idea for teens especially.
Well, since we know, Tom, that cell phones are so distracting, what about talking to passengers?
Everything I've seen indicates that that's less distracting or less injurious to the driver for several reasons. Number one, the passenger is obviously a second set of eyes who can, you know, not only look for hazards along with the driver, but also knows when to modulate their conversation. So if the situation is getting more sort of cognitively intensive on the road, the passenger can dial it back and basically shut up, whereas someone on the other end of a phone doesn't really know what you're up to, what the situation is, and so that would be one of the most immediate reasons. It does depend on the passenger, of course, and, you know, a car full of screaming kids could, I imagine, be more distracting than, you know, sort of a quick phone call creeping along on stop-and-go traffic, just to use one example.
Yeah, I would imagine. But one thing I believe I read in your book was that driving with a passenger actually makes you safer than driving alone.
Yeah, I've seen a few studies looking at, you know, crash records on highway segments, and then they went back and analyzed, you know, who was driving with a passenger, who was driving alone. And I'm not sure whether it's a protective effect, you know, the person who, you know, realizes they have someone else with them in the car, whether that passenger sort of comes between the driver and the car and is kind of this feedback mechanism that, again, urges them to drive more slowly or to which my wife, for example, often does, or, you know, sort of can spot these hazards. So I'm not quite sure what the exact effect is. There may be many, but there does seem to be at least a statistical relationship.
Hmm. Let's take a phone call. We've got Nick on the line. Nick, hi, you're on Voices.
Hi, how you doing? This is a great show for me. I am a driving instructor, and I agree with most of the things that the doctors, that the gentlemen are saying. It's really interesting because I get students that, particularly your last insight was, people that just learn how to drive in the beginning and as passengers, that have been raised in a car culture, that I find that they are easier to teach than students that have not been raised in car cultures, students that I have. As an example, I can get a student from a parking lot onto the street, the average student, within a half an hour, and driving and really feeling and knowing that they're learning how to drive and they're doing things correctly, I mean mechanically correctly, okay? Other people from other non-car cultures, I find that they're much more difficult, okay? They require more work, they require more lessons and things like this, but eventually they do get it.
What do you mean non-car cultures?
Well, like India. I get many students from India, okay, that people that have been raised in, like, places and villages and things like this, and where they're not exposed to cars, they haven't been riding in cars. That's what I mean by non-car culture.
Interesting observation. Thank you so much for your call.
Yeah, great show. I am learning a lot, and I am enjoying it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Leon, that's Nick's call was consistent with your observations about background.
Yes. I can tell from newspaper results. For instance, if you type in road rage on Google News, you get dozens of headlines every day around the country and around the world. It's a worldwide phenomenon, and I think it has to do with human nature as much as human culture. Both are involved.
What about human nature?
Well, when you consider that when we are in a car, we are constricted. We are immobilized. We sit behind a wheel. And other cars are around so that we can't just go whatever we want. It's both dangerous and restricting, so that we need psychological habits of thinking that are more adaptive. For instance, most people do what I call mental venting. Just like, for example, you did in the story that you talked about with yourself. In other words, we talk to ourselves. It's very natural. We talk to ourselves about what's going on. But we vent in the sense of being, we express emotions of protest, of outrage, of we want to retaliate. In other words, this kind of emotional venting is something that we need to learn to get hold of, to control, and only then will we be able to become really better drivers.
Hmm. Let's go to the phones right on that point. We've got Jenny on the line. Jenny, hi.
Hello?
Hi, Jenny. You're on Voices.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I was actually driving. I've pulled over to talk. But my question was, why do people feel so free to express their anger on the road? I know people who I wouldn't even call assertive, but put them in a car and it's almost like their personality changes.
Yeah,
every frustration and anger that they have comes out. It's like they feel better cutting people off in traffic. It's a victory.
Jenny,
and I was just wondering why, if you or the guests had any insights into why that happened.
Well, before I pass it on to our experts, tell us about your very self. Tell us about your very self.
Oh, me? I'm one of those people who does have a conversation with myself and reminds myself that it's not worth it. It's, you know, safety first, and, you know, I have to talk myself through it because I do find myself getting caught up in that. You know, how dare he cut me off, or what the heck was that, you know, turn without a turn signal for?
Yeah.
So I really have to talk myself into calming myself down again.
Well, you know, to validate your point, not that it needs validation, I've got a friend who is a Buddhist, and he's an aggressive driver. My God, he's a Buddhist, you know? And you know, our guests don't know that I'm a quadriplegic, which means I've got no finger function. I can't move my fingers at all. And one of my great frustrations when I first started driving was I couldn't give anybody the finger. You know, it's like I couldn't express myself. So let me turn to you, Leon, with Jenny's question. Why do we do it?
I would say we need to look at the broader picture in the sense that aggressive driving is both a philosophy and an attitude, as well as a weakness. It's a philosophy because people have a certain idea about road regulations and civility. In other words, this does not apply to me at this time. They make exceptions for themselves. And it's an attitude because a lot of people look at driving as a competition rather than as a cooperation, which is what it is. Driving is a social cooperative activity. It's interactive. When I step on my gas, somebody else has to also in the back of me. And when people go outside the boundary of this cooperation and define it instead as an attitude of competition, then we have this problem.
Well, let me stop you there, if I may. Where and how does that transition get made? What's that moment when we go from cooperative to competitive? Does it happen as soon as we close the door to the car, or is there something about the situation?
It's both, because the situation is unpredictable, and we're fine. We're going along fine. We're driving. All of a sudden, something unpredictable happens as a result of another driver's activity. Now it's up to us to react to it with emotional intelligence. If we don't have that training in our traffic emotions, instead of emotional intelligence, we do the opposite. We do venting. We suddenly start aggressing. We have a sense of territoriality. It's very strong. And it's not completely logical. It's also a little bit cynical. So when you combine all these negative attitudes and the unpredictability situation of the driving, you have this explosive combination where two people are making a mistake at the same time and coming together with it.
We've got to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk about what happens to us when that door gets closed and identity shifts. We become more anonymous, and I'm guessing we become way more narcissistic. But we'll do that after our break. We're talking about traffic today, what it is, what it does to us, and hopefully what can be done about it. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. If you've got a traffic story, I know most of you do, give us a call. 888-477-9499. My guests are psychologist Leon James. He's an author of Road Rage and Aggressive Driving. He's taught traffic psychology at the University of Hawaii for the last 20 years. And his website is drdriving.org. I'm also joined on the phone by Tom Vanderbilt. He's author of the book Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do and What It Says About Us. His blog is How We Drive. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
I'm Peter Sagal. Saturday on the Best of Public Radio 2008, a conversation with Antonin Scalia about doing justice to the English language.
Just imagine the Gettysburg Address. We can't honor, we can't consecrate, we can't hallow this ground. Come on.
Join me and Fred Child for the Best of Public Radio 2008 and your chance to help make great radio in 2009.
This Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. I am not Bruce Springsteen. My guests are Tom Vanderbilt, and he's the author of Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do and What It Says About Us, and Leon James. He's the author of Road Rage and Aggressive Driving. He teaches traffic psychology at the University of Hawaii. Speaking of traffic and Bruce Springsteen, I said I am not Bruce Springsteen. As a matter of fact, the only place I am allowed to sing is in my car when the windows are up. Everybody who knows me and loves me have told me that's the only place I'm allowed to sing. So that's the good news about being driving anonymous, where nobody can hear you when you're alone. But apparently there's some pretty bad news about the anonymity of driving in cars. Yes, Tom?
I think so, absolutely. If you look at the sort of work of a psychologist like Philip Zimbardo, who was famous for doing experiments in which people were urged to potentially give victims sort of electric shocks or punish people in certain ways, they found they were much more likely to do this when the victims were hooded and you could not basically see your eyes. It's been this is the sort of firing squad mentality that the person doesn't want to. The person pulling the trigger will be less likely to shoot if they can actually see the eyes of the victim. And I think we are sort of anonymous in our cars. We can really only make out other people's license plate numbers or vehicles as a whole. We sort of tend to treat cars as people, which is an interesting thing to me as well. But and there are those moments when it does break through when you do see a human face, someone waving you in to let them in front of you, and does feel quite warm and satisfying.
Hmm. Let's go to the phones. We've got Deborah on the line. Deborah?
Hello, am I on the line?
You're on.
Oh, hi.
Hi, you're on your cell phone. Where are you? What's going on?
Well, I'm actually driving, but I'm on a hands-free set, so it's not that dangerous.
Okay.
I have a question. Every day I commute home on 676, and there's a spot, and there's spots like this on all highways, where everybody is supposed to merge over, and there's an exit lane that you're only supposed to be in if you're getting off. But every day, lots of people take that exit lane all the way up to the last possible second and then cut into the line where the people who've been doing the right thing, like me, have been waiting for like 15 minutes. And basically, it's cutting the line. And I think that the people who do that, they wouldn't do that if I were with them in a store or something, but they're doing it on the road. And I just wonder, is there anything to be done about that?
What have you thought of doing, Deborah?
Well, sometimes I pull up right in front, because I'm a person who keeps a very long following distance from the car in front of me. But the only thing I can do is pull up right up to the car in front of me to not let them in. But it's like there's a rule that's supposed to be followed, and these people aren't, and they're getting home faster than everybody who is following the rule.
So these people get you really PO'd, and you want to do whatever you can to not let them in.
Well, I don't think it's fair.
Right. All right. Well, I got good news and bad news. Well, I got bad news. You sound a little bit like me. And that's not a compliment, Deborah. Let's hear what our guests have to say about that. Leon, Deborah's story sounds like a lot like mine when I introduced the show. That, you know, we get aggressive.
Exactly.
But she's right. I mean, it's not fair. So what do you do with that sense of injustice?
It's true. There is this sentiment, this feeling that it's unfair. And so what we have to do is to realize that the only thing we can do is to deal with our own feelings. We cannot very much influence the behavior of other drivers. Now, like what Deborah is doing is closing the gap and preventing the other driver from getting in. But actually, we have to realize that that's not going to be to our advantage to get involved that way. In other words, if Deborah and all of us would get involved in a different way, say what I call supportive driving instead of aggressive driving. Now, what would I say if I was involved in supportive driving? I would say, oh, another driver wants to come in. Okay, let me make more room for him. Or there's another driver. Oh, got ahead of me. Okay, he's going to get there first. In other words, we start identifying with the positive aspects of what's going on with the team cooperative aspects rather than the competitive. If you're involved with the competitive, then it is unfair and your frustration is going to be negative and you're going to feel terrible. So it's not a solution. In terms of merging, it's always the case like that. There are those who are late, what they call late mergers or early mergers, and there's a big debate among engineers as to which is better, whether we should merge early, like Deborah wants, or whether we should allow people to merge late, go all the way to the end, and then merge then. Well, the point is that sometimes late merging is better. And so if we are involved in preventing others from passing us and keeping track of how many cars have passed us, we are involved in the aggressive emotions. So the only thing we can do is to give that up, to train ourselves as we are sitting there. That's what Deborah could be doing, you could be doing, and I could be doing, is to talk to ourselves, supportive driving, emphasize the positive aspects. Let them go ahead. Let them be ahead. We all have to get through. We all going to do it.
Deborah, are you still there?
Yeah.
I think we've made it clear so far on the show that Leon is a nicer person than I am, especially behind the wheel. But I want to tell you this, that what I do that really helps me a lot is when I see someone doing that, what I say to myself is, thank God I'm not living inside that guy's head. You know, can you imagine how awful it is to live inside that person's head that moment? And, you know, on a good day, I can feel compassion for that person and their family, you know, and grateful that I'm not there. You know, I'm living inside my head, which some days is pretty good.
I think that's true, and I think the point that I've often wondered that, like, maybe everybody should wait until the last minute to merge, and that's a question I have, and, you know, I'd like to, if, I don't know, maybe there could be driver education about how to do that right, because clearly there's a lot of disagreements about
right.
that.
And
I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you one thing I'm hearing from Leon in so many words is, regardless of what's right and wrong and regardless of what's just, that cortisol that's being dumped into your veins is hurting you, and that's the issue. Is what can be done to diminish the harm that's being caused to your body mind in that moment? That's really all that counts. Nothing else counts, as far as I'm concerned. Okay.
All right. Thanks.
Good luck.
Bye.
Gentlemen, as Deborah referred to 676, that is one of our many lethal highways in the Philadelphia area. It's just awful. Tom, consistent with that, you found that the most stressful event while driving is merging from three lanes to two.
That was shown in a survey by the Texas Transportation Institute. And merging, this whole late merging thing, is actually what got me to write the book, strange enough, because I really am just a civilian driver. I'm not, you know, in this field. I wasn't previously. And the merge situation I'm talking about is not as the caller described. I was talking about kind of a construction zone where it's quite clearly marked that, you know, two lanes are dropping to one, and there's sort of a vague instruction, merge right 1 mile. Well, what does that mean? Merge right now, merge as soon as you can, merge at the actual merge point, which creates all sorts of ambiguity. The situation the caller is describing, I tend to view as outright just cheating. Unless, another case, as often happens on the highway, the person is not from the area and has been caught unawares that they're in the wrong lane. So traffic provides a lot of room for ambiguity, and in that space we tend to come in, I think, with our own mental models of what the right thing to do is. And in the case of late and early mergers, you have two people who are equally convinced of what they're doing is the right thing, and neither actually really knows the truth in most cases.
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Steve on the line. Steve, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I just want to call and thank you for the opportunity here. My father was a really aggressive driver with muscle car, and there were numerous occasions where I threatened to turn his key off if he kept it up. And in three circumstances, I actually did it. I turned the key off on him when he was trying to cut the person off, and then he had cut him off. But what I found over the years is techniques to basically deal with these aggressive drivers. And the techniques I've used is, I picked up from the European driving of 2 years, where you drive defensively if you just don't survive, especially on the Autobahn. And the techniques I've developed is you get a wraparound rear view mirror so you can see the cars coming behind you. You know when they're going to, how fast they're going, and that the likelihood of cutting you off on an exit is going to happen. And then the convex mirrors on the side mirrors that you have help you out with the blind spot. But keeping an eye on the rear view mirror, what's coming at you from behind, is the key to basically defensive driving. You know where they're going. You don't pull out in front of them. That's a technique to really get them mad. But the other technique I have is I record their license number and the description of the car and description of the driver if I can. And what I'm curious about is who can you turn that piece of information into?
Interesting question. Leon?
Yes. Partly, I think we need to be careful because defensive driving gives us a certain vigilante attitude towards other drivers, like the last caller, that's an example. I'm not saying this as an insult, but we all have this. We all have this tendency, and so what we need to do is to fight against it. The only way to do it, I think, is to accept, to be more supportive. In other words, if somebody passes you, instead of thinking defensively that it's unfair or that it's dangerous, how can I accommodate better to make this person, what they're trying to do, make it safer for them and for me? And I think that's the only solution. So we have to talk to ourselves in a different way. Most of the time we talk to ourselves in a competitive way, and we try, and we are at war. We are at war. It's highway warfare.
Well,
so I think that's what we need to do. We need to become at peace with one another.
Well, let me raise this question on Tom's behalf, Leon. What we heard from both of our callers was a fact of injustice. I mean, driving that puts somebody either at risk or delays somebody's time, I mean, that's a fact of injustice, and everything in our psyche pushes us to restore justice, to make things whole, to make things more balanced. I mean, it's that's really hard to turn your back on, psychologically speaking. You know what I mean?
Yes, it's true. You know, you said I seem to be a better, more supportive driver, but actually I have the same trouble that you described. I started my interest in this 25 years ago when my wife said to me one day, Leon, grandmother doesn't think you're a very good driver. And I used to drive her around once a week, and she's 92 years old. And so I said, what's wrong? What did she complain about? Well, when you make turns, for instance, you're doing too fast, or she gets knocked against the seat, and she has to hold on, and it's not dignified. She doesn't feel an old lady should do that, and it's the driver that should adjust his behavior to the passengers. And this was a completely novel idea for me. My idea was the driver is the one who chooses the radio stations, the driver is the one who chooses the air conditioning settings, the driver chooses about how fast he should go, and the passengers should simply adapt. This kind of overwhelming attitude is what I had, and I think most people do. That's what we're working with. That's why it's so difficult. It goes deep into all our relationships and our motivations.
So it's interesting. Underneath it all, we're all a bunch of narcissists, but when we close that door, it comes out from being under wraps. You know, it is our car, it is our road, it is our entitlement.
Yes, people feel completely entitled, and what we need to do is to broaden this attitude, have an attitude of latitude, I would call it, to be able to allow less territoriality.
Yeah, let's get another phone call in before our break. We've got Dolores on the line. Hi, Dolores?
Hello?
Hi there.
Oh, hello. Thank you for letting me come on.
Sure.
My question has to do with my role as a passenger. He was just speaking about that. And I'm generally a very pacifist driver. I prefer to let dangerous people go ahead, and I want to get out of their way as much as I can. But when I'm with someone who is driving and something happens and the driver gets very upset, I get upset. And I don't know how, you know, I'm sitting there unable to do anything about it. And I, you know, I don't want to see anything bad happen. And there I am, you know, helpless and defenseless.
Well, tell me about that word upset. If the driver gets angry, do you get angry?
Yeah, I get angry. I want to get out of the car and walk.
Well, it sounds like, Dolores, if a driver gets angry and aggressive, you get frightened.
Yes, I do.
Okay. All right.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the options? Let me turn to you, Leon.
Yes. In my book and also on my Vector Driving site, there is something called a contract that a passenger and a driver can sign together so that the driver can agree in advance to treat the passenger humanely. Because what we're talking here is the human rights of passengers. And drivers haven't been trained to respect the human rights of passengers. So this contract kind of makes it a little bit official. But it is true that I get Dear Doctor Driving letters, people complaining, women, for instance, that their husband or sometimes the father doesn't want to stop for long trips for bathroom stops and tells them, well, hold it for another hour, we'll get there. This is just one more example of the way drivers abuse passengers. And so it's very, very serious. And it's part of that same syndrome of being aggressive. You can be aggressive towards other drivers, or you can be aggressive towards your own passengers.
Your example, Leon, about bathrooms and bathroom breaks raises a whole theme that I want to talk about after our breaks, and that's gender differences between drivers and how different genders react to different situations. We're talking about traffic today on Voices in the Family. I am not going to give out our phone numbers again because we've got a lot of traffic on the call board, and I don't want to get anybody angry. Our guests are Tom Vanderbilt. He's written the book Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do and What It Says About Us. He's got a fascinating blog called How We Drive. Leon James is a psychologist. He's written Road Rage and Aggressive Driving. He's also the creator of a program called Road Rages, and it's for aggressive driving. It's used in many states throughout the country, and you can find more about him at drdriving.org. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb, and this is Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
For millions of families throughout the world, the live Christmas Eve broadcast of a festival of nine lessons and carols heralds the beginning of the holiday. Hear the Christmas story told in words and music by the world-famous choir of King's College. I'm Michael Barone. Do join us for a festival of nine lessons and carols, live in Cambridge, England, from American Public Media.
Wednesday morning at 10 o'clock on WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, the copyright wars of the digital age. Lawrence Lessig says young people are growing up sharing and remixing music and video on the internet in ways that are officially criminal. He advocates reforming antiquated copyright laws. He founded Stanford's Center for Internet and Society. Lessig joins us on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Great music and lots of music around cars and traffic. That's what we're talking about today on Voices with Leon James, psychologist who's written Road Rage and Aggressive Driving. Tom Vanderbilt is author of the book Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do and What It Says About Us. Tom, you said in your book that more men blow their horns than women. There's really no surprise there. But you also found that both men and women tend to blow their horns more at women than men. So at one level, I could just say that women are not as good drivers as men, but I don't think so.
Yeah, these were a fascinating set of experiments done at stoplights where the light will turn green and the car, the researchers will hold the car and see who's behind them and wait to see who honks and why and how they honk, because you can honk in many different ways. And I mean, one issue that would come up in that situation is that both the male and female driver might actually fear less retaliation from the woman driver in front of them. They might feel it's safer to honk at a woman, which is one issue. But yeah, as far as who's a better driver, that's a huge debate that should probably be the subject of another show, but I'll side...
Not this show.
No. I'll side with the women, and not just because they read more books, but...
Leon, is what's going on here with this survey that Tom just talked about, is this a microcosm for gender differences in the larger culture?
Exactly it is. Yes, I think so, because the way we express ourselves, the way we express emotion, and especially the way we express aggression is dependent on, is regulated a lot by our gender. So, for instance, I got a letter once from a woman that said, yes, I flip other drivers off, but I keep my hand under the dashboard while I'm doing it. And that's a woman, and that's an example. Women feel aggressive emotions, and they feel frustrated just as much as men do, but they're trained culturally to express them very differently, so that's what's going on in the car. Men generally will express overtly their aggression. But when we think about this, we've got to think about our feelings, our thoughts, and our actions. So that's what I call the threefold self of the driver. And as far as the affect is concerned, where we have our feelings and emotions, they are very, very intense in the driving situations, and that's where we need to get hold of ourselves.
Hmm. Let's go to the phones. We've got Evan on the line. Evan?
Yes, hi, thank you.
Sure.
I was interested in hearing the words vigilante and also entitlement used by your guests. And I have a little story about how I react when somebody clearly non-handicapped parks in a handicapped space. I was once trying to get into a really difficult parking lot where I could just barely get off the street into the lot and wait for somebody to back out for me to back in. And this big Lincoln came up behind me, so he was on the street. And after a second or two, he started honking. And nothing I could do, so I waited, and I got my own parking space. And then I saw him pull in real fast and aggressively and park in the handicapped spot. He gets out of the car. I get out of my car, and we're about to head into the store at the same time. I look at him. He's clearly not the least bit handicapped. And so I say, half under my breath, but wanting him to hear, "Well, I guess your handicap must be mental." To which he responded, and I get a great laugh out of this to this day, "Yeah, well, I can make you handicap." And nobody got physically hurt, but I just wanted to say, I just get so outraged when somebody thinks that they are entitled to park somewhere where they are clearly not allowed. That's probably going to make it very much more difficult for someone else.
Well, I have to tell you on a very personal level that,
yeah,
you know, I require handicapped parking spaces, and I don't
right.
have much flexibility. So regardless of rights and wrongs and health and not health, I want to, on a personal level, thank you for your outrage.
Well, you're quite welcome. And you know, there's never a time I wish more that a police car would pull up so I could hopefully get that officer to give the $300 or $400 or $500 ticket to this fit, strong, and obviously quite arrogant and feeling entitled man who took that space.
Yeah, that seems to be a theme we're hearing, is that theme of entitlement. Evan, thanks so much for your call.
Sure, thank you. It's a great show.
Leon, any reaction to my interaction with Evan? I thanked him for his for outrage, because he was doing a larger service. You, I would imagine, aren't happy with my response.
It's okay. I'm happy because I think it's completely natural to have that response, and it's also healthy. But I would just add that it may not be the last stage. In other words, it may not be the place where it's the best for you and for all of us to stop, and that we need to go on beyond that. In other words, there are going to be people, scofflaws, who are going to do that, who are going to break the law, or who are going to take that parking space when they're not supposed to. As long as there are going to be such people, we need to go to the next stage after our frustration and our disapproval. We simply need to find psychological ways of talking to ourselves so that we can ignore them. Now, what this gentleman did, muttering under his breath and then having a kind of a verbal road rage exchange, all I'm saying is that it's dangerous for him to do that.
Of course it is.
That something else could have happened.
Of course it is, and perhaps in the ideal sense, if not a healthier way of talking to himself, maybe even ideally a healthier way of talking to the other person. So maybe it could be instructive for the other person, because what happened between the two of them certainly isn't going to change the other guy's behavior.
That's right. So it's really not worth that kind of interaction. It's dangerous, and it's something that you have to put up with, and we need to deal with these issues politically. So we need to have more people, you know, parking attendants kind of thing.
Tom, consistent with what Leon said, you've made an observation that ants don't get into traffic jams. I'm not a scientist, but I certainly never noticed a traffic jam among ants. So what does that say about them versus us?
Well, they're all related, which helps. If we were driving out there with our siblings, I think we would all sort of behave in a much better fashion. This raises this question. Again, we're driving these huge societies. We're anonymous. We're not going to see those people again, which is, on the one hand, you know, it's a good thing. But it raises the question, what is our impetus for cooperation? And if you look at some of the studies in political science, they'll do these games in which people have to kind of contribute money to a communal pool in round after round. And they find that when people try to steal more money than they're entitled to, they get punished in the following round. So the thing that sort of keeps them in line is what this guy Robert Axelrod called the shadow of the future, the thought that you're going to be judged on your actions in the next round. In traffic, we often don't have that next round. There's really no chance you're going to see that person that wronged you again. So, again, how do these get sorted out? And some people have argued we need a sort of national how's my driving clearinghouse, if you will, in which people, the caller could have taken maybe a cell phone photo of that violating Parker and mailed it into this organization run by the government, presumably, which would then, you know, go against his insurance rates, or there would be some kind of outcome for his action.
Leon, final question. What's your vision of the future? Not what should be, but where do you see us going? Especially with climate changes, the economy, difficulty selling cars, our push for going green. Where do you see us going?
Well, right now, there's a new phenomenon on the road that's worth noting, and it's called hypermiling, or hypermilling, some people say. And that's a whole new way of driving because it has to do with saving gas.
Mm.
And the two cultures are now developing on the highway, the hypermiling and the non-hypermiling people, and they are in conflict. Another warfare situation, I'm afraid. I think the future needs to recognize what I have called lifelong driver education, and I believe that's the only way we're going to make it is if we continue after our license and before we get our renewal, we need to do continuous self-improvement exercises on some basis.
I think that's a wonderful idea, and both of you are talking about the importance of political involvement in helping diminish this problem, which is very clearly a problem that can be diminished. I want to thank you both so much for joining us. It's been a great show, and thanks to all the callers who called in. My guests have been Tom Vanderbilt. He wrote Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do and What It Says About Us. I was also joined by Leon James. He wrote Road Rage and Aggressive Driving. His website is drdriving.org. Next week, we're going to be talking about a phenomenon that stays with us from birth to death, and that's loneliness, the very human experience of loneliness. It's a fact of life and can cause us anguish. So do tune in for that one. If you want to reach us directly, we're at voices@whyy.org, and you can reach me directly at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Kevin Griffin. Elizabeth Perez Luna is the executive producer of radio content. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. This show is co-produced by Gita Simons and Elisa Walters. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Have a good week, my friend.
And the foreign car's absurd. Me, I wanna go down in a silver Thunderbird.